all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northfield, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today is Amy Shively Hawk. She's written a particularly poignant and personal story about her father, who was a captive in Vietnam. He was a pilot with the United States Air Force and was shot down over Vietnam. Amy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Why don't you go ahead and start telling us about your father, his early years before he got to the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Sure. Well, he grew up in Spokane, Washington, beautiful little city over here on the West Coast in the Northwest, and just had a kind of a typical middle-class childhood, two parents and a sister. He grew up just basically obsessed with baseball and riding his bike. And then in high school, he very much excelled there. His parents were really keen on him getting a good education and a free education, so they basically required that he apply to the United States Air Force Academy. It wasn't really something that he wanted to do or had a passion for, but of course he did apply and he got in, and then that really set the course of his life from there.
It's an interesting story because oftentimes we hear of somebody who went to the academy who it was their lifelong dream to go do that or lifelong dream to go be a pilot. But here, really, Jim Shively went there for the education and found it was a difficult place for him originally to adjust to, but adjust he did, didn't he?
He sure did, and he really excelled there. He was an excellent student, got very good grades, and it was an expected course of action that their highest students would go on to pilot training. So he did and found that he just absolutely loved to fly. It turned out to be really the passion of his life. He went to pilot training in Arizona and then on to Nevada to Nellis Air Force Base for his combat training and just loved it. He was a risk taker, but he was smart. He loved to be in the air. He loved the exhilaration of it, and he was an excellent fighter pilot.
And Amy, one of the things that you've mentioned is that he was a pretty smart guy, demonstrated in high school how competent he was, but also at the academy. The Air Force sent him on to Georgetown University, where he picked up his master's degree in international relations before he went off to fly in Vietnam. That shows you're a pretty smart cookie, and your father certainly was.
He really was, and that degree ended up serving him later in life, too.
So we'll get back to that a little bit. That's why I wanted to make sure we mentioned it up front, because it'll tie in a couple of places where you go, well, this guy's smarter than your average bear. But tell us about what experiences a young pilot in that period of 68, 66, 67 would have been having in Vietnam, how many missions they were had to fly and those sorts of things.
Sure. Well, he was sent over in 1966. He was 24 years old, and he was sent over to Southeast Asia to fly 100 missions over North Vietnam. That was his assignment. On his 69th mission, a surface-to-air missile was shot into the back of his plane, and it exploded the back off, and he had to eject out of the plane. He was injured upon ejection and landed in a rice paddy north of Hanoi.
So he's, folks, he's 24 years old or so when this happens. And as the title of Amy Shively Hawk's book indicates, 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, he now spends the next 6 years as a Vietnam prisoner of war. Amy, tell us a little bit about your dad's early years adjusting to, you know, that difficult situation.
Well, it was obviously extremely difficult. He had never expected or anticipated to be shot down. You know, as I mentioned, he was the best of the best when it came to fighter pilots over there. It was a very dark time for him. They captured him almost immediately, stripped and beat him, paraded him through the streets, and then threw him into what the prisoners came to call the Hanoi Hilton, which was really a dungeon-like holding cell internment camp. He was thrown into solitary, tortured and beaten and starved. He had infections that were left untreated, so he really was near death in those first, I would say, about 6 months. It's a miracle that he made it through.
And the physical deprivation was as challenging as the mental or emotional. As I read your book, I really get a sense of both things occurring to him. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, he talks about, I took this story based on tapes that he left before he passed away, because when I listened to the tapes, it brought me into what he really went through. He had never talked much about his experiences when I was growing up in his home. And I think that's very typical of a lot of our veterans. So that's why I wanted to write this book and to bring out the fact that it wasn't even just the physical debasement, but the mental torture that our veterans were put through as well. He was really just dehumanized, you know, forced to bow. At any moment, he could have his life taken from him. The interrogations were brutal. And then, of course, they would plant, you know, seeds in their minds like, America doesn't care about you. It was a lot of psychological warfare as well that he had to work through. So I know that in those first few months, he actually wished that he hadn't ejected out, that it would have just been better if he would have gone down with his plane.
Amy, back up a little bit and tell our readers about the source material here. You were fortunate enough to have your dad's own recollections recorded. Tell us how that happened and how you used that information.
Well, it really was fortunate because, you know, he didn't talk about it. Of course, when I was growing up, and he's my stepdad, he married my mom when I was 5 years old. He just didn't really talk about it. We knew, of course, that he was a war hero. He was a fighter pilot. We knew he had been a prisoner. But the real details of his captivity, he kept mainly to himself. And it wasn't until after he died that I discovered that he had made some recordings with a reporter up in Spokane who had hounded him for years to get his life story on tape, because this reporter was just fascinated and just felt that this was a story that needed to be told and needed to be preserved. And so when my dad found out that he had cancer and he got that diagnosis, it occurred to him that this was going to be his last opportunity to get his story out. So I think it was just easier for him to sit with the reporter than with, you know, any of his family. And after he passed away, the reporter gave me the tapes, and I listened to them and just sobbed my way through them because, of course, I loved my dad, and it was very difficult to listen. But as I listened, I just knew that his story needed to make its way out there, not just to honor him, but to honor all of our POWs and veterans that served.
Well, I think that's an important point that your book does pretty well, which is it wasn't just Jim Shively who was a prisoner of war. You talk about many of the other men that he was captive with. Tell us a little bit about those guys and the information you got from some of them to help round out the story.
Sure. Well, I was able to interview John McCain, who, of course, is our nation's probably most prominent Vietnam prisoner of war. He was a friend to my dad. They were in the camp together at the same time, and I was able to interview him, get his some of his own personal stories, and then he wrote the foreword for the book, which was very gracious of him. But I found out a lot from the men. I found out probably the main thing that I didn't realize before was that it was really each other that kept them going, because they had to be strong for the next guy. If they were in solitary, it was very difficult because they weren't having any communication and they had no one to rely on. But when they were put in the camps with other men in the cells, they felt that they needed to be strong for each other. And so that was one thing that really came out in the book, was that if it hadn't been for each other, it would have been much more severe.
And I think, listeners, this is why you really want to read the book. One of the reasons is the story about how the men, sometimes cellmates, sometimes they're in isolation and they're doing the tap code through the wall, but how they got each other through the mental hardship and the illnesses. I mean, a lot of illnesses just from their lack of food and medical attention. You do a great job of describing how they took care of each other in that regards. Amy, do you want to tell one of those stories?
Sure. There's one story that comes to mind. When my dad came out of solitary, they threw him in a cell with a couple of other guys, and it was a lucky break for him because one of the guys he had known in flight training school, so they were able to reconnect. But what ended up happening is that he ended up getting hepatitis, and he had raging infections because he was injured upon ejection, and so he had really deep cuts in his arms that were left untreated and got infected. So this infection was in his system. He had dysentery. He was vomiting all the time. And when I interviewed his cellmate told me, he said, "Amy, I don't know if your dad even knows this, but we kept him alive. We force-fed him the pumpkin soup stuff that they gave. So if it wouldn't have been for these men, he wouldn't have even survived. They made him eat and kind of nursed him back to health."
And even some of the medical care they had to do for themselves. You've got a story about your dad having a raging ear infection, and the only treatment, if you will, was to take the hot light bulb out of the ceiling to warm up a cloth so you'd have something hot to put on that infection and hopefully try to drain the pus. How did they, oh my goodness. I don't know. Did he talk about that in his recordings, or did you hear that from his fellow prisoners?
He actually did mention that one. This ear infection went on and on and on forever because, of course, they didn't give any medicine out. And they were forced to, if you could call it bathing, I think it was only once a week in this particular camp that they were able to get cleansed at all, and then the water was dirty. So it just wasn't healing up. And he would take a washcloth and get it hot on the light bulb and then just press it to his ear just to try to help with the pain. But then he would also have his cellmate push on the back of his ear, push everything forward so that the pus and everything could come out.
Again, I don't think many of us can fully appreciate the deprivation that these men went through and how they survived. Let's talk about some of the things that they did as a group to help them get through surviving. You write about Hanoi University. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, that was something that came up in the later years. It was about 71, I believe, after Ho Chi Minh died, that the men were all brought together into the same camp. And the result of that was that they were able to group together in larger numbers, which was really a blessing because they could take good care of each other, but also they started a Hanoi University because you have to realize just how boredom was the other mental anguish. You know, they weren't allowed to have books or cards or anything that might exercise their brains at all. So they started teaching classes. They would assign one prisoner to teach whatever he knew a lot about, and then they would just take turns teaching each other. But they ended up making it very structured, so you would have courses and classes and tests, and it turned out to be a real blessing for them, just as a way to exercise their minds.
And again, I think there's a little bit of that creative human spirit where when you're working together, you talk about how a couple of the prisoners were native Spanish speakers, so they were teaching Spanish to others, or your dad was teaching Russian. He had advanced degrees, as we mentioned earlier, from Georgetown in International Affairs and taught some of that. I have to imagine that really elevated everybody's spirits, thinking about we might get through this, although we never know when we'll be released. Can you talk a little bit about how that not knowing when impacted the men?
Well, it was really a roller coaster. There were so many kind of up and downs because they would have air raids. The United States would have air raids. So the men would sometimes see the American B-52 bombers, you know, coming up over Hanoi, and it would give them, you know, a great sense of, okay, this war is about to end. America's coming back for us. Well, those would come, and then they would go, and there wouldn't be any change, or the treatment would get even worse. So it started becoming just extremely nerve-wracking because it got to the point where they just felt like they couldn't hope anymore. I mean, how many years of torture and starvation have to go by before you just start to completely lose hope? And that was the other reason that they really had to depend on each other, because you know, even if a majority of them were downcast and in despair, thinking that they were never going to get out, never going to get their lives back or die in the camp, you know, there would usually be one that was saying, no, come on, guys, we're gonna make it out. And it just takes that one person to lift up their spirits and give them that resilience. And, you know, that is really what the book is about, and it's really the message of my dad's life, is keep holding on to hope and persevere and don't let go. Because what I realized when I was writing this book is that his situation was extremely brutal, and most of us will not ever have to face anything like that, but we will all have dark seasons. And I found myself even just clinging on to this endurance that I was kind of getting contagiously through my dad, because it really made me think, okay, if I'm going to be strong like Jim Shively, I'm going to persevere through this situation or this diagnosis or this relationship issue, whatever it is. So this book is really for anybody that needs an encouragement to just keep hanging on, and you will triumph on the other side.
I absolutely agree with you, Amy Shively Hawk, author of 6 Years in the Hanoi Hilton. this book's about hope. As I read what you wrote about whether it be the church services that they held or the singing of the national anthem to raise their spirits, or the American flag sort of made out of a tattered handkerchief by Mike Christensen, a naval pilot. These are stories you tell that give you hope. Let's go to the time after your dad gets released from the prison camps, returns home, decides that he doesn't want to stay in the Air Force as his career, and turns to settling down with the family and pursuing a new career. Tell us a little bit about how he took those experiences forward for the rest of his life, because while he was in a prisoner of war for a long period of time, you know, he had decades now to live as a free man. Tell us how it impacted him.
Well, it really did. For one thing, there's kind of a sweet love story in the book, kind of very subtly, but he and my mom had dated in high school, and they dated while my dad was at the United States Air Force Academy. But when he was sent over to Vietnam and shot down, you know, my mom didn't know if he would ever come back, or how long he would be over there, if he would die. And as the years went by, she finally realized that she needed to move on with her life. So she met and married my biological father and had me and my little sister. But when Jim came home, when the war ended and he was released from prison, she ended up divorcing my biological father and moving back to Spokane to marry Jim. And it's just kind of just another element within the story of, you know, he thought that he had lost the love of his life, but really they were always meant to be together. And they got married right away. He adopted my sister and I and raised us in his home. And then they went on to have two more daughters. And it was kind of funny that they had four girls, because one of the things that he had said, you know, he only ever laid eyes on men for 6 years. They never even saw a female. And he had said to his cellmate at one point, "When I get out of this camp, I want to live in a house full of women."
He got his wish in that regards. He went on to become a practicing lawyer and ultimately an assistant U.S. attorney, I believe, in Washington State. Tell us a little bit about that and his opportunity to use his education to give back to veterans.
Yes. He decided that he was going to not stay in the military. I think having my mom back in his life and then, you know, having two ready-made daughters, you know, and having more kids, they had more kids right away. He just kind of decided he wanted to stay put. Family became very special and important to him. He didn't want to travel. And he went and got his law degree, which he turned out to be exceptional at. He had already had his master's in international relations. And he became a very well-known attorney for the United States government. Before he worked for the United States government, though, he took on a case, Jim, that became widely known, and it was for a Vietnam veteran. And he took the case when nobody else would, because the veteran was clearly guilty and had committed a felony. And my dad looked through all his files and met with him and said, "I'm going to take this case." And it turned out to be a case that really turned out to advocate for veterans that needed mental health care that they weren't getting from our government. And so he was one of the men, one at the forefront of standing up and saying, "Okay, we need to take care of these guys." Before post-traumatic stress disorder was even a term, he was at the forefront of advocating for mental health awareness for veterans.
This is, listeners, this is a story of a real American hero, and that term can be overused, but when you read this book by Amy Shively Hawk at 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, you'll find out that Jim Shively was from his entire body of work, from what he did in the service to his completion of helping veterans. This is a guy that we're all really proud of. Amy, I want to thank you for writing this. How can people find out more about what you're doing and find the book and that sort of stuff? Give us a website or two that they can follow you on.
Sure. I'm at amyhawk.com. The book is 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, and the foreword is by John McCain. It's available on Amazon.com and at Barnes & Noble and in bookstores near you. And I wanted to mention that I am partnering with the Headstrong organization, which they provide free mental health care to veterans that have post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an organization that I found that is run by veterans, so they understand, and it's a program that works. So I'm donating part of the proceeds from this book towards their organization because I know my dad would like that. He would want this to be about promoting health care and awareness for veterans.
Well, I'm sure he's proud of you up there, and we're certainly proud of him. We really enjoyed the book. I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.